Introducing Rabbi Lanad, or 9 o'clock sharp on a Thursday morning, as we zip along with Zoom, or Rabbi Adler, who'll elucidate us further with eye-catching shuvot. Take it away, Rabbi Lan.
Is that right? Wow, thank you so much. Thank you. Welcome, everybody. Good to see everybody. Harvey, nice to see you again 2 days in a row. How do you like that? It's a
The
very good
honor
thing.
sure is all mine.
That's very kind. Very kind. So thank you all for coming. Very nice to see you. Sorry we couldn't meet last week, but thank God today we're together. So today we have a few different things to talk about. This is kind of like the show 60 Minutes. You know, they cover like three, four, five stories. So that's kind of what we're going to do today. We'll see how far we go with different topics. The first topic is something I've always wondered about and never really understood. Education always begins with curiosity. So I was very curious about this particular thing and looked into it and came up with some interesting thoughts. So the first thing that we're going to look at today is what is the status of this idea of saying a pasuk for your Hebrew name? I don't know if this has been discussed before. If it has, I'm ready to move on to topic number two, but if it's not. So I think we're probably familiar with this notion that everybody has a pasuk, we try to say this pasuk. I'll say more about it in a moment, but there is this notion that especially in the Amidah, right before we finish the Shmona Esrei, before we step back and say Yule Ratzon, many people have accustomed to say their pasuk. Where do you find it? You find it in many sidurim. Sometimes it's right after the Shacharit service. Sometimes it's other places further in the sidur. And the idea is that your pasuk is a pasuk in Tanakh that has that begins with the first letter of the of your Hebrew name, and it ends with the last letter of your Hebrew name. So, for example, Ilan, my Hebrew name, Aleph Yud Lamed Nun Sofit. My pasuk that's suggested is Eilecha Hashem Ekra, Be'el Hashem Et Chanan. Aleph Eilecha is the beginning of the word Ilan, and Et Chanan, the final Nun, is the last Nun of the word Ilan. So that's my pasuk, and we'll talk about what other kinds of psukim one person may adopt. But even more importantly, what's the idea of this notion of saying, of everybody say having a pasuk and saying it? And we'll see, it's not just one time or three times during the day when we say the Amidah, but there are other times as well when we might want to use it. And again, the big question is, why do we have this? What is this notion all about?
Do you have where the idea began, the origin of this notion?
Yeah, that's what we're going to look at.
Okay.
Yeah, we're going to look at that. Where it began, I can't begin to know it, you know? But we'll take a look.
It's the first time it's mentioned, in other words, that's the, you never, we don't know where it begins, but we know the first time it's referenced, at least.
Roughly. I don't know if it's the first, but we'll see several references to it. And we'll see what this is all about. Is it a halacha? Is it a minhag? Is it an eitzah tova? Is it just a good idea? What's the purpose of it? Does it have an effect of saying such a pasuk? So we'll take a look at all that. So there is a widespread custom to recite this kind of a verse, either a pasuk that includes your Hebrew name, and many say that if you can find a pasuk that has your actual Hebrew name, that's even better than finding a pasuk that begins and ends with the first and last letters of your Hebrew name. So like I said, that was my particular pasuk that I find in various lists. We say this at the Amidah right before Yihyu L'Ratzonim Refi. That's the suggestion. And some say this minhag dates back to Rashi on a commentary on the pasuk in Micha. Micha, chapter 6, pasuk 9, where it says there in Micha, Kol Hashem La'ir Yikra, V'tushiya yir'eh shemecha, shimu mateh umi yu'ada. Rolls off the lips, doesn't it? It's just one of these memorable psukim. Very unusual words. Anyway, the sense of this pasuk is the voice of Hashem calls out to the city. It calls out to the city, and it is wise to recognize your name. It is wise to recognize your name. What does Rashi say about that? He says, from here we learn that whoever recites a verse each day that begins and ends with the same letters as one's name, beginning and ending letters, and he uses these words, begins and ends with these letters, shall be saved from Gehenna. Now, you might say, that's interesting. How do you know that? How do you know if it's happened, hasn't happened? How do you know if you were saved from Gehenna? What does it mean to be saved from Gehenna? So that's already Rashi. You might say, well, he tasted a little bit of his wine as he was making it, and that's what made him say it. All I can say is this is Rashi's commentary on that pasuk in Micha, chapter 6, pasuk 9. So, what is the connection between being saved from Gehenom and saying a pasuk? That's a question. Rashi indicates that this practice will save somebody from punishment in the afterlife, but he doesn't mention anything specific about when to recite it. He just mentions this as an overall benefit to reciting such a pasuk. It'll save you from Gehenom, but he doesn't say anything about when to recite it.
Rabbi,
Another, yeah.
this remind it reminds me somewhat of the idea of amulets,
I love them with cheese and onion,
and therefore
sometimes
kind of
mushrooms.
like a superstitious belief. It sounds,
Which
not
is even
completely
hard,
Jewish,
it's even hard to corroborate or to
not
confirm.
completely. It's not almost like a not a Jewish idea exactly, but an idea that, based on the culture people live in, might adopt something like this because it sounds very magical.
I hear you. I hear you. It's we'll see other sources that will say even more compelling things, but again, it's not something that you can't measure it. Nobody has come back and said, "Oh, I said my pasuk 3 times a day, and wow, the heat down there was turned down from 400 degrees to only 50 degrees." So nobody's come back and corroborated this idea, but let's—I hear what you're saying. Let's take a look at some of the other possible sources for this notion, and see what we find. So another possible source for this practice is the 16th century. We moved along a few hundred years. The 16th century Kabbalist commentary on the Siddur by Rabbi Naftali Hertz Trevis. Rabbi Naftali Hertz Trevis, who was a chazan in Frankfurt am Main, and a noted scholar. In the introduction to his commentary, he writes that there's an ancient tradition to regularly do the custom that we've been talking about, this pasuk, that has the first letter and the last letter of your name. That's how the pasuk goes. And he cites the verse in Tehillim. This is in chapter 119, the longest Tehillim in Tehillim, has 178 psukim, Kuf Yud Tet, and it's pasuk 108. It's the pasuk that begins with the letter Nun, one of the eight psukim beginning with the letter Nun. And he quotes Nidvot Pi Ritzena Hashem U'Mishpatecha Lamdeni. And that's his pasuk, Naftali, Nidvot Nun. And it ends with Lamdeni, Yud. Naftali begins with a Nun, ends with a Yud. And he says this pasuk corresponds to his name and the one he recites. What does he say about it? He says one should say such a verse when traveling. Wow. Even when you engage with others. Now, I don't know how that comes up when you engage with others. Like, where do you put that in? As you're ordering a steak and potatoes, right in between, you say your, I'm not sure. When learning, maybe when you begin learning, you say your pasuk, or when you end it, perhaps. But he gives no reason for the practice or any specific time to say it. He just says, again, 16th century, so we're talking about 1500s. He just says that this is a practice, and he widens it from not just saying it at the end of the Amidah, but at other times as well. We find an explanation for this minhag in the 19th century Siddur of the Rashban. The Rashban, this is Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani, 3rd century Amora. So now we've moved along another few hundred years. And he says, it says in the Yerushalmi, in Esther Rabbah, how contemporary, it says that Mordechai asked three children who had come from school to quote some of the psukim they learned that day. Some of us may recall that particular episode. Mordechai meets three kids. So what did you learn today? One child says he learned a pasuk in Mishle 3:25, Al tira mi pachat pitom, and then as it continues. The second child learned a pasuk from Yeshayahu 8:10, Utsu eitza vitufar. Dabru davar velo yakum. This is another pasuk. And the third child says, oh, I learned a pasuk in Yeshayahu 46:4, ve'ad zikna anihu, or maybe ve'ed, I'm not sure, anihu. And the question one might ask is, why did they quote these psukim? And it was explained that each child was taught his specific pasuk. This was done because children were often kidnapped or sold into slavery, and having children memorize a verse would help ensure that they remember that they were Jewish. It would help the community redeem them if it had to come to that. And so somehow saying these psukim over and over again was a guarantee, I don't know, a guarantee, but it was helpful to keep the children's Jewish identity in the forefront of their minds. And when community members might need to come and to redeem them, they might say, I'm here to redeem the following child, as it is symbolized by the following pasuk. Oh, okay, Naftali, Kibarain, you've just been redeemed. Okay. Another explanation for this minhag is that doing this specific practice will save a person from the following, and this is something I had not heard before. Not heard this before. You'll let me know if you did. That this practice of saying your pasuk can save a person from chivut hakever. Chivut hakever, which is a beating, B-E-A-T, a beating that is spoken about as a painful step of refinement after somebody passes away. I think the word chivut is like to smack or to beat. You would do that to a rug or a carpet. If you remember, people used to, I don't know if people still do that. They have this wicker kind of a thing and they smack it to get all the dust and whatever is in the rug. So there's something spoken about. Again, it's not something we can measure because nobody's come back and said, oh, that chivut hakever. Wow, you got to be careful of that. This is something.
Chibut
go ahead.
To, they say chibut aravot on
the Hoshanas. Right. Harvey, are you related to the gentleman who works for not Mada, or Zaka?
It was Hatzalah. He's my son. He still volunteers there, but he doesn't work there anymore.
Oh, he's like 49, 51 Zaychemin, something like that?
He's 49, and we're 54. We're across the street from each other.
Very nice. We were 41 for several years. So that's, I saw his motorcycle out there.
He still has that.
Anyway, so this practice of saying your pasuk can save a person from the from what we call the chivut hakever, is a painful cleansing process that takes place after death. In fact, there are some ancient sidurim included that they include a harachaman. I've never seen this. It includes a harachaman in Birkat Hamazon, asking Hashem to save us from this chivut hakever.
Wait, what is this? Chivut hakever is something, it's not something that we do. Something
Something is done to us after
to
we pass
us.
away.
Okay.
Okay?
Like
So I'm going to try
otherworldly.
to explain it, but I have to say I don't understand it well. Maybe some of us will understand it better if you do let me know, but I can't say I stand on firm ground when I say the following, because I don't fully understand it. Okay, I'll be honest, I don't even not fully understand it. But here's a teaching about it. This Chivut HaKever, it is written in the Midrash of Rabbi Yitzchak ben Parnach that when a person leaves this world, the angel of death sits on his grave. His soul then immediately returns to his body, and he stands up on his feet. Now, what does that mean? The soul, it's all in a grave, stands up on his feet. Okay. How does he do that? So Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi said further, and in his hand is a chain, half metal and half fire. The person is then hit. This is the chivut part. He's then hit. With the first hit, his limbs are broken, and with the second, his bones are broken. And with the third, he is turned into dust and returned to the grave. I'm just reading you what I read. Rabbi Meir taught that the judgment of Chivut HaKever is worse than the judgment of Gehenom. Okay. Here's another teaching about Chivut HaKever that I didn't understand well. That's more relate clearly related to the minhag of reciting a verse. The students of Rabbi Eliezer asked him, "What is the exacting of justice in the grave?" He replied, "When a person leaves this world, the angel of death comes and sits on him, beats him, and says, 'What is your name?' And the person says, 'I don't know.' Immediately he places his soul into his body and stands him up and puts him on trial." This is written in the Sefer Chochmat HaNefesh. In the Zohar, it's taught that the wicked don't remember their names. And reciting a pasuk to remember your name ensures that you'll remember it. And when you are put through this kind of judgment, this will be a benefit for you. Thank you for not asking me any more details. Has anybody heard of this, seen it? This was totally new to me. Just a little bit more about this. It says in the Sefer Ben Sion, he writes that he heard from Kabbalists that everyone should find a verse for one's name from somewhere in Tanakh and recite it regularly to save oneself from this Chivut HaKever. It is especially auspicious if the verse begins with your name or at least appears in the Pasuk. So that would be better than finding a pasuk that begins with the letter and ends with the letter of your name. To
I did
find a pasuk that
remember.
begins with your name, or at least appears in the pasuk. Yeah, what were you saying, Sean?
I do remember hearing something a little bit similar when I was a kid, and they said
Go
you
ahead.
say the pasuk so that when you get to the Olam HaEmet, you die, you get to heaven, so they're going to ask you your name, and you'll be able to remember it because you were saying the pasuk. I mean, it's not in the Kever, I mean, whatever, it's something similar, but I think I don't understand it as much as you do.
Oh, I understand it less than you think, as much as I. It's
But
just a new concept that I'd never heard of. This idea of
one.
the not the name part, but the Chivut HaKever part is something that was brand new to me.
One thing I did see about when to say it,
Yeah.
we had a neighbor, Oliver Shalom, Michael Pomerantz from the
Oh.
bookstore. And
Oh, yeah, sure.
every time he came to shul in the morning, and he'd come before davening started, he would open the doors and he'd come and he'd say, "Matovu halecha Yaakov mishkenotecha
Oh,
Yisrael."
that's
It
his
was
pasuk.
Michael, that's his
Yeah.
pasuk.
Oh, nice.
And but that's like the only time I really see it, happening on a regular basis.
Right. Does anybody here this morning hear people talk about their pasuk, or do you use your pasuk? I mean, there's more to say about it, but is this something that's common? Anybody having a sense of it?
I use mine.
I don't think most of them that I see don't even have it.
Most Siddurim don't have it. Oh, I know the art scroll has it. I don't know if the
Oh, well, that's
Koran.
definitive. The art scroll has it. That's it, you know.
Then, sure, if the art scroll has it.
The Rina Yisrael doesn't have it. That's for sure.
The Koran
Okay.
doesn't have it either.
Koran doesn't have it either.
I found mine in the European Kol Bo Machzor for Rosh Hashanah. After
Wow.
Shacharis, there's a whole list.
Oh, okay.
But it doesn't explain why those people who have the same pasuk, like Ariel, Uriel, I can't think of some, but there are some that have six or seven or eight names attached to the same pasuk because they all start with the same letter and
Yeah,
end with the
right.
same letter. So when you get to Shemayim, if you're supposed to use the pasuk to remind you of your name, you can be really confused.
Right. So maybe that's the suggestion from the Sefer Ben Sion, that if you can find a pasuk that begins with your name, or that has your name in the pasuk, it might be a better way to remember. I don't know. Okay.
I've seen. I saw was in some sort. I remember where there was a list. Didn't have the names. It just had like the first and last letter, and then you know, hopefully yours was there, and then you would just use that pasuk.
Yeah, that's the way Art Scroll has it.
Okay. I guess that's where I saw it,
Can
and
always rely on
that's
Rabbi
also good.
Feder. Well,
I
it
mean,
has the full pasuk in Art Scroll, if
it
I'm
has a
not
full
mistaken.
pasuk,
It's a
but
full
it doesn't
pasuk, but
say.
not the
Let's say
full
for
name.
Moshe, it doesn't say Moshe. It just says Mem Hei. And if you also have Mem Hei or Aleph Yud or whatever you have, you just use that pasuk. It doesn't make a difference what your name is.
Yeah,
It
it's on the
works
very. In the,
also works for women.
oh yeah, for women too. Yeah, there's a yeah the.
Mem
Right.
two dots Hei.
Right. But then it gives you a pasuk right after that.
Right.
Right.
Torah tziva lanu
Right. So we know that there's a person. Well, we know we understand that a person's name is deeply connected to the neshama. For example, when we at the grave, when we visit the grave or the day of the burial, we some people will say kapitlach of Tehillim that spell out the person's name. So now, Ot Mem for Moshe. Next, all the psukim for the letter Shin, etc.
Rabbi,
So we see like Mishnah,
that.
Neshama are the same letters, and many people make that kind of a connection.
Does this work only on the name you're given at birth, or what if my mother was known as Joni. Her name was Miriam Yehudit. She didn't like the first name. She went by Joni. I only found out her birth name after she passed away. I was
Oh.
then. I found out what her Hebrew name actually was. So, again, assuming this is a little bit on the magical side, the magic only work on the birth name or the name that you know nor like with, or either. It's the.
I'm not sure. It's a in all that I looked at during those 3 minutes. No, it was more than that. In all that I looked at, I didn't see that aspect discussed. There are some that recommend that if you have multiple names, like Gaboyim, they sometimes have to deal with an Aliyah. Yamod, Yitzchak Yisrael Malka Ben Moshe Shmuel Aaron. You have that.
No, we know in a ketubah, people have to include the real name, the nickname, the
But that's
whatever
more
the
in
name
the
is.
get.
On the
I
get
think
route.
more in the get, where you include nicknames. Demitkere Charlie, Demitkere Charles, Demitkere the Chuck. I've seen many a string of
I'm
names.
looking for the linkage between this idea of the name and the letters and the. Whatever does, you were saying that it's linked to the neshama of the person based on their name, but they may not know. What if the name is Charlie? They don't have a
Right.
Hebrew name. I mean,
Or they may not know a Hebrew name. How often did I have to do eulogies, funerals, and eulogies, where I asked the children, "What was your mother's Hebrew name?" Nobody knew it. Nobody
Some
knows.
people don't have Hebrew names. I was saying Kaddish for a guy. His name was Leonard Ben Avram. I haven't met who he was. He didn't have a Hebrew name.
What was the first name?
Leonard, whatever.
Oh, okay.
I said Kaddish, but I don't know what would you do. You would, Leonard, how would you say the name?
Yeah.
Is that English spelling?
Yeah. I had three sons. They didn't know their mother's name. They're looking at each other, and they finally said, "Oh, now I remember her name." And they said her Hebrew name was Fresca. I said, "I doubt she was named after a soft drink," but they were convinced Fresca. Okay, maybe it was twanged in a way that they didn't understand. Whatever, but
well, her middle name was Cola, so it seems to fit.
Antu de Shalital Cola. He's the rabbi that gives the hechsher on Coca-Cola. Yeah. Okay, so we have the sense that a person's name is deeply connected to their neshama, their life purpose, perhaps. Related to this is when the angel asks Yaakov for his name to understand his essence. When Adam HaRishon named all the animals based on the essence of their character, their neshama of the animals. Anyway, so in the Kitzer Shla, in the Kitzer of the Shla, regarding matters related to this idea of Chivut HaKever, evil people do not know their names in the grave, and they get beaten with cruel beatings, he says. But one who was accustomed to the minhag that we're discussing of saying your pasuk, and especially if the name is in the pasuk, it is a segula. Not to forget one's name, and one should say the pasuk in the Shmona Esrei before Yihiyu Leratzon. The Rebbe Rasha.
So that would only be, if a person is a Rasha, then he would have to make sure to do that, and then, but you know what? And then he doesn't get beaten the kever, even though he's a Rasha. So what? You know, what have we accomplished?
The sense that I'm getting. Is that all of this accomplishes that you get less, not that you don't get any of what you might deserve, but somehow it ameliorates the full judgment against you. Somehow, somehow it helps. It helps to lessen as opposed to totally remove the punishment, whatever the punishment is. So what does the Rebbe Rashab say, Reb Shalom Dov Ber Schneerson, who was the fifth Rebbe, 1860 to 1920? He taught the following. He says, the letters of the verses of names, which we say in the Shmon Esrei, are the Torah letters which purify the part of the neshama from the filth caused by the body's materialism. You hear this a lot in Kabbalah and Hasidut. The neshama and the guf are in constant battle. The neshama wants to do what is pure. The guf is often pulled in many directions because of what it sees, what it wants, what it is attracted to. And the neshama is kind of forced to go there, but it's not where it wants to go because it has a purer purpose in this world. And so says the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe that these verses and the letters of the verses, they help to purify the neshama. Now that could be even while you're living, but when one reads the Kriyat Shema al Hamita before we fall asleep, as it should be read, he says, each person according to their ability, and declares Beyado Afkid Ruchi. Then through the letters of the Pasuk, one merits that he is allowed to stand near the open doors and see what transpires in the heavenly chambers. That's something else that I don't particularly understand. But what we do get from this Rebbe Rashab is that to say the Pasuk and to say the letters of the Pasuk, these are all helpful in gaining more spiritual access of some sort or other. So we've been reading all about the Mishkan, and we see that Bezalel was a Yodea Machshavot. Bezalel knew the secrets of the letters. Bezalel knew all kinds of spiritual matters that helped him create the vessels of the Mishkan, etc., and how it's put together. And he knew the secrets of the Otiot. So what does that mean? And I don't know exactly what that means, but there is this notion within Kabbalah and within other areas that these things help. Again, is it measurable? What can I tell you? We'll just say a couple more things, move on to the next topic. One who has more than one name should recite a pasuk for each one. Others say, no, one pasuk is enough. You don't have to, for all of your names. Yitzhak Aaron Tzvi Ben. No, just one. Pick a name and say the pasuk, and that should be enough. In a source called Az Nidberu, they ask the question, if you do it right before Yula Ratzoni Mrefi, is saying that pasuk a hefsek? That's an interesting question. Have you caused a hefsek now in your Amida by saying this seemingly extraneous verse? And the Az Nidberu says, no, they're really recited as a form of prayer. Now, on the face of it, like when you look at it through the art scroll and you see that whole list, doesn't look like a prayer. But now, as we have an ounce's worth of understanding about this, Chivut HaKever and all that, it could be seen as a prayer to be released from all of the terrible things that could happen to us in judgment once we have passed away. Does it look like a prayer? Honestly, it does not. But some people say it's not a hefsek because it's actually, if you peel it, peel this pasuk to its purpose, it's helping us to not experience the full judgment that we might experience if we hadn't said that pasuk. So it can be a form of a prayer. Last thing, Likutei Sichot says, that a woman should do this as men should do this. And the custom to use Tehillim 119 with chapters using the name of the sick or the departed also gives a little bit of strength to this idea of how names and letters are connected to strengthening the neshama either in this world or in the next world. So. Okay, any questions, observations, thoughts? Does this move anybody to find their pasuk and say it? All right, I'll be honest, it did me. I didn't know my pasuk. And now I know that that's the what I quoted in the beginning. Elecha Hashem ekra v'el Hashem etchanan. Is there any kind of prophetic aspect to that? Like if I really looked at that pasuk, does it speak to me? Does it describe me? Does it... I'd have to think about that, but
you have to decide what's in the name, who makes up the name, how is the name assembled. It's the whole.
Yeah, so there's a sense that when parents name their kids, they have a certain amount of nevuah. It's they think they just said, oh, let's call them Yechezkel Aaron. No, their sources would say that didn't just come into your head. That there was something going on that gave you a little bit of prophecy, and that's why you called him. I can tell you also many, many times, and I think I've said this before somewhere, many times when I was doing an intake for families for a funeral, and they would describe the person in all of his or her fine detail. At the end, I would say, oh, yeah, by the way, what was their name? And they would say the name, and I would think to myself, oh, you didn't even have to tell me because it describes exactly. You know, so a woman who is very regal, royal in her bearing. She came into a room and you could tell that that the air was all of a sudden different. The way she carried herself, et cetera, et cetera. What was her name? Esther Malka. I could have told you that. You know, that kind of a thing. If this did anything, it got me to be more, a little bit more educated about this idea. And now I know my pasuk. Have I said it as often as I could have since learning about this? Honestly, no. But now I know, and maybe I'll try to weave it into my rituals. Okay. So the next thing I want to talk about is what is the reasoning behind the three steps back at the end of the Amida? I think most of us do that. The end of the Amida, we take three steps back, we bow in different directions. Many of us then take three steps forward. Many of us stand on our tippy toes, this little jump on the balls of our feet. At the end of that, what is that all about? Are there rules, regulations about this ritual of the three steps back, three steps forward? So that also drew my attention. It was very eye-catching because I do it all the time, and I can't say that I was always aware of why this is done. Anybody have any ideas before we talk about it? Why do we do it? What's the source? Who, what, where, when, how?
I don't know what the source is, but supposedly you are withdrawing from the divine presence. That's a symbolic withdrawal.
Okay, I think that's what most people would say. You step back before the Amida in order to step into a presence, a consciousness of a presence. One would ask the question, well, you couldn't do that without stepping back. And perhaps one answer is no. You step back to appreciate where you're stepping into, or something like that. Anyway, so a few interesting thoughts about this, the three steps backward, three steps forward. The Rama in the Shulchan Aruch, 95, Tzari Hei, right at the beginning of that halacha, the Rama says, before beginning any Amida, we take three steps forward to approach Hashem. Doesn't seem to say anything about three steps back, but you should take three steps forward. Again, it's a consciousness of stepping into a reshut of more intimacy with Hashem. So you step into that.
It was linked to Eglon, King Eglon of Moab, took three steps towards I forget his name now. The hero with the withered right arm. Because Eglon took three steps forward to hear the voice of Hashem, the message from God, that, I mean, it's probably some kind of an asmachta.
Was it Eglon or Nebuchadnezzar?
No, it was Eglon. Eglon took three steps towards, I don't remember his name right now, Ehud, towards Ehud.
And
he said he had a message from, he had a message to give him from God.
Oh, there's something in here about three steps forward. I thought it talked about Nebuchadnezzar. Maybe he did something. I don't
know. He did three steps too, you know, the hooji wooji.
He did the three step. Yeah.
It was
a popular dance back then.
The shofar, Chris' sister, his mother cried. Andre, I mean, you know, I doubt the historical veracity of these stories, but they're nice, and they give us a certain linkage to a pasuk. We tend to like that.
We tend to like shooting the arrow and then putting the circles around it.
I didn't say it, but you got the gist.
Okay, so let's see where this goes. The Mishnah Berurah, also in Tzadi Hei, says it's a common custom is to take three steps back and then three forward. The Mechaber, Rav Karo, just talks about the three steps forward, and the Rama says, just to refine that a little bit, we also take three steps back in order to take those three steps forward. He says it's not an essential part of the ritual, but for Kabbalistic reasons, it should be considered. So the stipler Rav Yaakov Kanievsky Zatzal, he didn't step backward. He just did three forward from wherever he stood. Wherever he stood, he just did his three steps forward. The Kaf HaChaim remarks in a nearby halacha in the Tzadi Hei. He says it's an act of humbling oneself before davening, and it's a sign of respect and reverence. It's a sign of respect and reverence. We step back in order to step into a different mindset, a different atmosphere, a different spiritual environment. And if you just stood without moving anywhere for the Amida, it would be like the same old, same old. So you do something different. You step back in order to step into, and now you're perhaps in a different, more reverential, more respectful headspace for the Amida. Many say that we begin with the right foot. When you do your three steps back, the idea is you begin with your left foot, the three steps back with the left foot. The left foot is generally a sign of hesitation. And we go with the right foot when we step three steps forward. The right foot is generally indicative of speed. We want to rush into this divine intimate space with Hashem. That seems to be a very common thing, a common thread that I've seen. There are three prevalent customs as to when to begin the steps backward, right before the Amidah. One custom is prior to Tehillot Lekel Elyon. Some people step back then. Others, right before Tzur Yisrael. And others, right after they conclude Ga'al Yisrael, then they begin the three back and then the three forward. The three steps backward or forward are intended to be reminiscent of Moshe. This is interesting, I think. Moshe, who approached Hashem in prayer on Har Sinai after passing through three different barriers, darkness, cloud, and mist, MIST. This is according to the Mechilta in Yitro. As he's going up on Har Sinai, he's passing through three different barriers, darkness, cloud, and mist. So when we do that before the Amidah, we kind of imitate that idea. It also recalls Bnei Israel distancing themselves from Har Sinai for three milin, whatever that distance might be. After they heard the frightening voice of Hashem, they went back like, oh my gosh, what was that? As we know, the Midrash talks about them being afraid and scared. What was that? And then they later returned to their place. That's according to one source, and that's what we do when we take three steps back and then three steps forward before the Amidah. Also, the three steps represent the three times in Tanakh where the word Vayigash is mentioned to refer to tefillah. Avraham, Yehuda, and Eliyahu. They each have references using the word Vayigash where they're davening, and so maybe it comes from that idea of the three steps back and forward. And at the end of the ramp leading to the Mizbeach in the Beit HaMikdash, there were three steps that the Kohen ascended to reach the Mizbeach, and after he would descend those three steps. And so we make a connection because the Amidah serves in the place of the Korbanot. So that's a tighter kind of a connection. And if you want to see more ideas and more interpretations of these three steps, you can look in the Or HaChaim, Kuf Chav Gimel, and you'll see more on that. Now, these three steps have taken after Ga'al Yisrael are considered not a hefsek. Some say it could be a hefsek, but rather it's a component of the prayer. So it's not considered so. If the three steps forward bring you close to another davener, you can forego it. In other words, you're in a tight space. Wherever you are, and you don't have room to take three steps forward, so you can forgo that idea. At the end of the Amidah, we take three steps back in a bowing posture, as a slave leaves his master. So we leave that space, contrite, humble, and our posture indicates that. Many people, will bow in three different directions. The backwards are especially significant. As we are taught, this is in Sanhedrin 96a, that Nebuchadnezzar was given permission to destroy the Beit HaMikdash as a reward for taking three steps to honor Hashem. Okay, in Yoma 53b, we see that one who is negligent with the three steps back is better off not having davened at all. That's an interesting perspective. If you didn't do it, it's almost like saying your whole davening didn't matter. It sounds a little harsh, but that's the opinion. The first of the three steps should be with the left or the weaker foot, as I mentioned. as if to show our hesitancy in leaving Hashem's presence, and that three steps backward should be modest, not grandiose. I've seen grandiose. I don't know if you've ever seen that, where people take three huge steps backwards, and they, when they go back to three steps forward, also three huge. And many say it's not necessary to be that demonstrative. Just, it's for yourself. It's not for other people to see. Just quiet, modest steps. If you can't do them forward and backward, you do them to the side. You can do them diagonally. And if you can't do them, many say, don't worry about it. If you're in a wheelchair, somebody who's in a wheelchair should roll their wheelchair the approximate distance that they would if they didn't have the chair. one source in the Kuf Chaf Gimel says that the Chazan does not take three steps backward. Interesting. As his three steps back at the final Kaddish will take the place of those three steps backward. So that's interesting. This is, again, the Machaber. This is Rav Yosef Karo. He says that the Chazan, when he finishes his Amidah, should not take the three steps backward, but rather wait until the Kaddish at the end of the Amidah, and then when he says Oseh Shalom, those three steps will suffice as the three steps backward. That
you don't have a Kaddish in the Shacharit. You go to Tachanun, and then the Kaddish is only after Rashi Valetzion.
Right. Yeah. So that's a good question. It's a long time. Maybe he would say that Kaddish after Valetzion is that Kaddish, that those three steps taken back are in place of, maybe.
But in the meantime, he said the Chazan says Tachnun, and he sits down to say,
right.
You know.
He sits, he's walking around, he goes to get the Torah at the Aron, whatever. Yeah, you're right. So this is what I saw as the best way to do it, that when we step three steps backward, Oseh Shalom Bimramav, we bow to the left, and then we say Hu Yaseh Shalom Aleinu. We include the word Aleinu as we bow to the right, which I think most people don't do it that way. And then we say V'al Kol Yisrael, we bow straight ahead. I think most people would do like Oseh Shalom Bimramav, Hu Yaseh Shalom, and then Aleinu, they would include that word straight ahead, but there are sources that say you say Hu Yaseh Shalom Aleinu, you include that word. One shouldn't take more than three backward steps, says the Aruch HaShulchan. There seems to be no source for standing on the toes, as I mentioned earlier. Many people, when they take their three steps forward, they kind of like bounce on the balls of their feet. There seems to be no source for that. That is done at the end of the Amidah. Okay, so the last thing I want to take a look at is pretty brief, and if we don't yet hit 10 o'clock, I have something to mention. It was a question of, can a siyum be made on a daf of Gemara? A siyum. Can it be made on a daf? So, it's a what?
Rav Riskin has such a story about a man started to learn later in life.
Oh, so maybe this is it. What I'm going to relay now, that could be the story that he talks about.
Obviously, none of these are there's a long list of customs. And I imagine customs can be adopted one way or the other, sort of for people that don't have a custom yet. I mean, if you're accustomed to a siyum every time you finish a masechet of Gemara, you probably wouldn't make a siyum on a daf.
Yeah,
unless
it would seem
you're learning that daf with someone who never learned anything. And maybe you would then.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you're misayim a lot of masechtot, you're not likely to throw a big party for a page. But so this, what I'm going to relate to now is a very lovely anecdote, and this could be what you're saying about Rabbi Riskin mentioned this. There is a student who shared with his non-observant parents what he learned during the week at Misifta Tiferet Yerushalayim, which is where Rav Moshe Feinstein's Atzal was based. He was based there. As the father, the non-observant father of the cup of his parents, as he heard more and more about what his son is learning, he was intrigued by it, and he decided to study Aramaic for 3 years, according to the anecdote, and he mastered what was needed to understand the flow of the Gemara. Okay? Why it took 3 years or only 3 years, it's a whole different issue.
Must be
But
before art
he,
scroll.
it's what?
I guess before art scroll.
Before, right, way before Art Scroll and and Rev Steinsaltz. Anyway, so what did the father do? The father did this in order to be able to do a page. He completed one daf. This is the non-observant father. Maybe he became observant during the process. I don't know, but he completed one daf in a very thorough manner, and he asked if he could make a siyum. So the son said, it's common custom to make a siyum only on a whole masechet. And the father was not very happy to hear that. So the son, I think it's the son, went to Rav Moshe Feinstein, who, and he told him about this discussion. And Rav Moshe said to him, I've never been to a siyum of a single daf, but he said, your father should make the siyum and I will attend. That's already a higher level of saying it's permissible. Let him make it, and I will be there. It's very nice. Anyway, they held the siyum. The father taught the daf as part of the siyum. They had a big meal, lots of music, singing, dancing, festivities. Continued. This whole festivity continued until the very early part of the morning. After the siyum and the party, the father went to sleep and never woke up. So Rav Moshe remarked that a person's entire purpose in this world could very well be to complete a single daf. Anyway, I thought that was very, very sweet. And you're right, there are a lot of minhagim that we have. We don't have the time to go into this, but were we to have like another 15, 20 minutes, which we don't have, I see David is here already. There's a whole interesting question. There is this accepted notion that when you give mishloach manot, the manot need to be of two separate brachot. Am I right that this is the notion? Right, you don't give two pieces of cake. You don't give. They should have two separate brachot. And what we don't have time to see is that there seems to be no source for that, unless somebody in this group finds a source or has a source. I'd be very interesting to hear it. But I
It's
was
probably
look.
in the second Megillah, where
It's what?
probably in the second Megillah in the Gemara, but it's curious that you were supposed to give some kind of food item that allowed the person to have a little bit of a meal
Right,
experience,
right. So
and
that's the
then
most
we give
accepted
them
idea is you're giving food to be used at the Seuda for that person.
so M&Ms and a Twinkie. I mean, whatever it is, probably shouldn't count. I mean, what we call junk food, which is very
Yeah.
commonly given. I mean, it's
Yes, a nice bucket, a nice plate, a nice box with all kinds of things that you don't know what to do with because it's a month before Pesach and you hope everybody eats this stuff. Unless people give kosher Pesach stuff. But what we don't have time to look at, maybe quickly next week, Yemirtz Hashem, is that there, for example, if you look at Rav Rimon's Sefer on Purim, which is just fabulous, just fabulous. I don't know if it's come out in English, but I have the Hebrew, where he discusses this. There's no mention at all. No mention at all. I posted this question on one of the rabbis' lists, the RCA listserv list. Does anybody know where this idea comes from? That the manot in Mishloach Manot should have two separate brachot. The learned rabbis that responded said, as far as I know, and as far as I've learned, there is no source for this. As a matter of fact, there are some sources that even allow non-food items to be given as Mishloach Manot, and you are fulfilling your obligation. Even by a porcelain bowl and a wooden spoon. So you would say, wow, that what are you going to do with that? The idea is that perhaps you can sell it and then you can have a better seuda. You can sell those items and have more food, better food, higher quality food in your seuda. And there are those that say, and with this we will end, there are those that say that two different parts of a chicken, the thigh tastes different than the breast, or the wing tastes different, whatever, that's you're also fulfilled your obligation with Mishloach Manot, two different types of cakes, even. One is a Danish and one is a whatever, and it's not two separate brachot. But unless you can find something, there seems to be no particular source for this idea of, uh-oh, we don't have a second bracha in this Mishloach Manot. What do we do? I thought that was very eye-catching, that there is seems to be no source for that. If anybody finds it, you can let me know, Rabbi Adler in Israel at gmail.com. So,
Thank you very much. Thank you.
thank you very much, everybody, for
Thank you.
being here today, for joining us. I appreciate